The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Pulmonary thromboembolism is presented by Dr. Thomas Morley.
All right, our topic for the next half hour is going to be thromboembolism. And the thromboembolic disease is an interesting disorder. It can present from somebody that has a small subsegmental clot in their lungs with no symptoms, all the way to people that have cardiac arrest and near sudden death. So that it's a very varied presentation that we have to deal with. We all know that the acquired factors for venous thromboembolism are, to a large extent, nothing new. Virchow's triad has been known for centuries. Venous stasis, vascular injury, and hypercoagulability. Obviously, people that have a prior history of previous thromboembolic disease, prior surgical history of trauma, immobilization, cancer, and you can read the list. The ones that are more interesting are actually the newer causes of hypercoagulability. When I was in training, we had protein C, protein S, and antithrombin 3. Well, since that time, there's been the development of large numbers, factor 5 Lyd being the most common one that we see now. And obviously, important to recognize people that are hypercoagulable because they may need longer durations of therapy or maybe lifelong durations of therapy. So we have to be able to identify them. So I just wrote down a small list or a simple list of what makes us think that somebody may have a hypercoagulable state. Obviously, if you have clots in a low-risk patient, either pulmonary clots or thromboembolism, or clots in their legs. Clots in odd locations, renal vein thrombosis, upper extremity thrombosis, cardiac thrombosis, any of those things should light you up that something's wrong. We shouldn't be forming clots in those locations. Anybody that's had recurrent clots are kind of a very important message that something's wrong and we need to identify what's wrong with the patient. Family history of clots and spontaneous abortion. So those are all the things that we would look for on a clinical basis to try and identify a patient that might be hypercoagulable. Also important is that most of the hypercoagulable states are only associated with venous thrombosis, but there are several hypercoagulable states that are associated with both arterial and venous thrombosis, and I just listed cancer, myeloproliferative syndromes, antiphospholipid antibody, hyperhomocysteinemia, and nephrotic syndrome. So, but anytime you have somebody that presents simultaneously with venous and arterial thrombosis, that should be a light. I mean, that's not a normal thing, and it should deserves a specific workup. The sources of pulmonary embolism are pretty clear. The vast majority are going to come from the lower extremity. Occasionally, we'll have catheter vein thrombi that will propagate up into the iliofemoral circulation. Also, you can have unusual sites when the venous Dopplers are negative of the lower extremity. You may have to look for other sides, right side of the heart, upper extremity thrombosis, renal vein thrombosis, iliac veins, and hepatic veins. So that, again, and also when in those unusual sites, that also might be the person you worry about a hypercoagulable state. Now, the key consequences of what we're going to talk about today is obviously people that have pulmonary embolism can get hypoxemic, and we don't need to talk too much about the hypoxemia. But what causes death in people that have pulmonary embolism is when you overload the pulmonary circulation to the point that the right heart can't maintain forward output. Once you have that, that's an extremely important finding, and I'll show you a slide about mortality that's associated with that in a minute. Excuse me. The other thing that will cause, aside from the extent of the venous that blocks the circulation of the lung, the other thing that causes trouble is the, we said about the extent, but also how quickly the blockage occurs. People that dump a large burden of clot into the pulmonary circulation very quickly, the right side of the heart can't compensate for that, and they'll go into dissociation and hypotension, et cetera. Also, people that already have underlying cardiopulmonary diseases are not going to tolerate large burdens of pulmonary emboli, so that they're at higher risk. This is pretty much what we just said, is that people that have pulmonary embolism, it's really overburdening the right ventricle that puts them at risk and of death. Also, as I said, they can get hypoxemia. The hypoxemia can lead to myocardial ischemia, which also can lower cardiac output, etc. And this is an important slide, is that When we talk about the death from people that have pulmonary embolism, as long as the right ventricle is being able to maintain cardiac output, mortality remains relatively low. It's not until the person develops a shock state that associated with the pulmonary embolus that they actually will have shock and actually require lytic therapy, which we'll talk about in a minute. If the clot burden is so high they present with cardiac arrest, mortality goes up into the 70% range. And obviously, if they present sudden death, then it's 100%. So that the ability of the right ventricle to maintain cardiac output is fundamentally important in people that have pulmonary embolism. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. Now, when we see people with pulmonary embolism, we really want to do a risk assessment of the patient in terms of how bad off they are. When we define severe pulmonary embolism, in Europe they call it a high-risk population. In this country we call it massive embolization. And what defines something's massive, it's not the clot burden directly on the right ventricle. It's essentially whether the person has right ventricular failure, whether they have acute core pulmonary. Now they have hypotension, syncope, and those sorts of things. Those are the people that are at the highest risk. So that the high-risk person, basically hemodynamic instability is what means somebody that's having a massive pulmonary embolism or high-risk patient in Europe. Also identifies the person that's going to probably need lytic therapy in order to survive the event. Some people would add to that list people that have refractory hypoxemia. We have the person on 100% oxygen. You can't maintain oxygenation. They probably should be lysed as well. Fortunately, most patients that have pulmonary embolism do not have massive embolism. About 5% of them do. But of the 5% that do have massive pulmonary embolism, those are the persons, people that have the highest risk of in-hospital death. It's about a 15% risk of in-hospital patient death. Now, as I said, most patients that have pulmonary embolism are not going to have pulmonary embolism. But some of the patients that present with some massive embolization to the hospital are going to have a bad course. They're going to have bad outcomes and that sort of thing. So it would be nice to have some further testing that will allow us to identify those people for more aggressive therapy. And there's a lot of studies that have been done that looked at it. For a variety of studies have looked at BNP for patients that have pulmonary embolism. And about 50% of patients that have pulmonary embolism will have BNP as a result of right ventricular strain. They believe that's what basically causes it. And it would be nice if we could stratify the patients that are doing okay now, but they have an elevated BNP to figure out who may need more aggressive therapy. Other things that have been looked at for that is troponin, very similar data on troponin. Elevation in this patient does predict that the patients may have a worse hospital outcome. Final thing that we look for is we look for right ventricular involvement. We look for right ventricular strain. And if you look at the far right-hand panel here. This is the left ventricle here, and this is the right ventricle anteriorly. And what you can see is the right ventricle is actually bigger than the left ventricle. That should never be. Basically, the reason that happens is you put so much strain on the right ventricle, it starts to dilate out. And when we see that, we become concerned that the right ventricle is not compensating and that the person may go on to have a bad outcome during the hospitalization. The problem with all these things, with right ventricular strain, with BNP, troponin, all of those things, is that they're not in and of themselves sufficient to say that somebody requires additional therapy. There's a lot of research that's being done right now to try and see if they can make kind of scores for these systems to identify people that may need lytic therapy or additional aggressive therapy. And that's what we just said. Now, the advanced risk classification system, risk stratification basically is that 15, 20 years ago, when we started treating people with DVT with low molecular weight heparins, it wasn't known whether it was beneficial or not. Well, now we know it is beneficial. The other thing that's being looked at right now for people that have pulmonary embolism is that there's obviously a subpopulation of people that have pulmonary embolism that are going to do well. They could be treated as an outpatient. We have now the newer oral anticoagulant agents that we can use, and it's clear there's going to be a population of patients that have pulmonary embolism that ultimately will be able to be treated as an outpatient. This pulmonary embolism severity index is a classification that can do that. It divides the severe patients from the not severe patients. And what's been shown is the patients that have the lowest risk classification, the stage 1 and 2 risk, basically can be treated as an outpatient and do relatively well. We need larger numbers of studies to show that, but I'm pretty confident that in New Year's when I give this lecture, we're going to be talking about exactly that. Now, in terms of assessment of the pretest probability of DVT and PE, we all use the Wells criteria. It's a pretty simple, straightforward system. You look for suspected pump DVT, alternate diagnosis, less likely than PE, heart rate, et cetera, you know the deal. And basically, we assign a score, a number of points for each one of those symptoms. If they have a low score, less than 2, the probability of pulmonary embolism is probably only about 3 or 4%. The interpretation that of risk is relatively low. On the opposite end of the spectrum, if you have people that have point scores that are 6 or greater, they have an almost 2/3 of those patients will have pulmonary emboli, and their risk is considered high. In terms of using that, for example, if people have a low risk score and a negative D-dimer, we'll talk about D-dimers in a second, it really probably is not worth putting those kinds of patients through aggressive testing. On the other hand, if you have a negative or positive D-dimer in somebody that has a high pretest probability, those are the patients that you're going to want to be more aggressive about testing. And this is just looking at the Geneva. This is the one they use in Europe, so we don't have to talk about that. The D-dimer basically is a helpful test in one of two ways. If it's negative, if you've had a high sensitivity test like an ELISA test, and the test is negative for the development of, the test is negative, the probability of having a DVT or PE is very low. Unfortunately, D-dimer is a kind of instance, lots of different things elevate a D-dimer, particularly somebody that's just had surgery, you're trying to figure out whether they have clots, it may not be such a good indicator for you. Now, I want to spend a couple of minutes just talking about the diagnostic techniques for pulmonary embolism, and we'll talk to each one of these individually. Now, EKG is basically not a very helpful test in terms of pulmonary embolism. Most common thing you'll see is tachycardia. They can have T-wave changes. I'll show you S1, Q3, T3. But basically, we look for signs of right atrial right ventricular strain. And this is just the S1, Q3, T3 that it showed you here. Unfortunately, again, neither sensitive nor specific for pulmonary embolism. Chest radiology, basically, most patients that have pulmonary emboli are going to have a negative chest x-ray. But if you have somebody that's coming in shortage of breath and hypoxia, and you find they have a pneumothorax or a pneumonia or CHF, they may give you the diagnosis that's responsible for the person. Also, if a person can only do perfusion scan and can't do the ventilation, the chest x-ray can be helpful in terms of interpreting that. We just had a patient had a VQ scan, was interpreted as high probability, but they couldn't do ventilation, looked at the patient's chest x-ray, and he had diffuse pulmonary fibrosis, so that's why he had the perfusion abnormality. The ones that we do, you might actually see on the exam, are Hampton's hump, Westermark sign, and Fleischer sign. And this, you can see at the left base here, there's an alveolar infiltrate. It looks almost like a pie shape that's pointing towards the hilum. That's the classic Hampton's hump, where you have a pulmonary hemorrhage into the segment of the lung, and it gives you the Hampton's hump. And this is just on a CAT scan. You can see the left lung, the kind of pie-shaped defect that's pointing towards the hilum. All right. And this is what's called Westermark sign. And Westermark sign is not a very common sign because you need a very large segment of the lung to be blocked. And generally, one side of the lung has to be much more involved than the other side in order to see it. Here you can see that the entire right lung looks densely, or it looks very oligemic. It looks like it doesn't have enough blood flow. And that's because there's a massive clot sitting right in the right pulmonary artery. You can see in the left lung that the it looks almost over-perfused because the blood flow from the right lung has been diverted into the left lung. So that's Westermark sign. And here's Fleischner sign. This is bilateral, in this case, it's bilateral pulmonary artery dilation in the face of proximal pulmonary embolism. You can see the pulmonary arteries are very dilated on the x-ray, and then you can see on the CAT scan very large proximal clots in the pulmonary circulation. Echocardiogram is extremely important when we have patients with pulmonary embolism because we want to assess the right ventricular function. We want to see if the right ventricle is functioning normally. We want to see if it's dilated. We want to see if its contraction function is normal. TEE tends to be more sensitive than the transesophageal is more better sensitive than transthoracic. Other signs that we look for indirect evidence on the echocardiogram is, as I said, right ventricular dilation of the pulmonary arteries, abnormal right ventricular wall motion abnormalities, and also dilation of the vena cava. That frequently happens in these patients. Right ventricular dysfunction is one of the things is that as the right ventricle starts to dilate, what happens? This is diastole is on the left side of the slide and systole is on the right. And the right ventricle, as I told you before, should be smaller than the left ventricle. And here, you can see the right ventricle is grossly dilated, clearly bigger than the person's left ventricle. And also you can see is that the septum, that the left ventricle should look more like a circle, so look like over here. When you have overload of the right ventricle, the septum kind of makes a D shape. It kind of collapses in on the left ventricle and impairs left ventricular function. That's what they're showing you there. So that's the D sign that we talk about. Now, other things on tests that we do is we do a ventilation perfusion scan. That's obviously a helpful test in certain circumstances. Here's a normal one. You have ventilation on the left. You have perfusion on the right. There's a ventilation looks normal. Perfusion, there's no defect. So this is a simple normal. If you have this test, a normal ventilation perfusion scan, extremely unlikely that the person has clots. So a negative EKG scan like this is extremely helpful. Very unlikely they have clinically significant clots. On the other hand, you have something like this, where ventilation looks relatively normal, but you've got large bilateral segmental clots. This is classic, the high probability scan that you get with the pulmonary embolism. And you can see them where all the arrows are pointed, that's where the clots are. This is just another high probability scan. Excuse me. A high probability scan where ventilation looks relatively normal, and perfusion obviously is these large, now again, see the one here that, I'm sorry, the one there that looks like a piece of pie, a pie shaped, that's a segmental defect where it looks like a segment of the lung. And then, so those are bilateral mismatched segmental defects, high probability. On the other hand, you can have defects like this where there's defects for pre-perfusion, but they're not segmental. They're small, what they're called subsegmental defects. That is not helpful. That pattern, when we see it, does not help us very much in patients because other things other than pulmonary embolism can do it. So the ventilation perfusion scan, as I say, when it's negative, extremely helpful. You can not treat people if you have a truly negative scan. In people that have a high probability scan, again, very sensitive and specific for pulmonary emboli. But many people that have pulmonary emboli don't have either a high or a negative scan. They have, you know, some bearing in between, and we need to do additional tests. Other issues with the BQ scan is that it takes about 2 hours to do it, so it's not a very rapid test, and it's only available when the techs are there to do it. Whereas compare that to echocardiogram, where you can just take the machine, go to the bedside, and do a test on somebody. CT pulmonary angiogram. I suspect that many of you have not even seen a pulmonary angiogram in your careers because it's largely been supplanted by using the CT pulmonary angiogram, which we'll talk about. A CT pulmonary angiogram is not very helpful for people that have small peripheral clots. But then again, small peripheral clots are not what causes clinical symptoms. So that, you know, seeing small peripheral clots may not be that clinically relevant. And the new guidelines say that if people have subventral clots with no DVT and no symptoms, they don't need to be treated at all. So. And this is what a pulmonary embolism looks like on a CT pulmonary angiogram. And you can see this is a saddle embolus going from right pulmonary artery all the way over to left pulmonary artery. And this is more of the same. You can see a segmental clot sitting in the left pulmonary artery. That's an interluminal filling defect. And this would be that one of the clots I told you about before. It's in a more distal artery. You can see some of the dye is getting past the clot, but you can see and there's a clear interluminal filling defect there. Pulmonary angiograms, this is the one you don't see anymore. This is a pulmonary angiogram. The pulmonary angiogram can detect extremely small clots, as small as a couple of millimeters. But again, those are not the clots that cause patients to have clinical symptoms. All right. The criteria is the same for it is for CT pulmonary angiogram. You want to see interluminal filling defects, and you want to see vascular cutoffs that are diagnostic. And this is what it looks like. Here you can see, your left lung looks relatively good, but a fairly large intraluminal defect in the right pulmonary artery. And you can see the lack of perfusion into the right upper lobe, and some impairment looks like in the right lower lobe as well. So again, if you do magnification of views of this and people have clots, you can see them out in these very, very distal arteries within the lung. But again, whether those things are clinically relevant is probably not. So the initial treatment of pulmonary embolism basically is going to be anticoagulant therapy. And anybody that's got a high intermediate clinical probability for acute PE should probably be just started on therapy. Just you don't wait, you just get the therapy, you put them on therapy, and then get your diagnostic testing. unfractionated heparin is kind of taking a back seat these days. Unfractionated heparin is a preferred therapy in a limited group of patients. People that have severe renal impairment, those that are at high risk of bleeding where you want to be able to reverse it, people that are high risk with hypotension, that kind of stuff. And as a rule, for anybody that's extremely old, frail, overweight, basically, they're still recommending unfractionated heparin. Having said that, most patients were kind of changing things here. So with that exception, low molecular weight heparin is basically, which is given subcutaneously and weight adjusted, is really the treatment of choice for most of these patients these days. Anticoagulation should be continued with unfractionated heparin. For most agents, should be continued for at least 5 days because during that time, the patient's hypercoagulable. Now, this is just some of the newer guidelines that was just come from last year. So the oral anticoagulants, vitamin K agonist, should be initiated as soon as possible if hemodynamically patients, well, that's not quite true, but we'll talk about them more in a second. When you put them on vitamin K antagonist, you want to get their level somewhere between 2 and 3 for the international normalized ratio, and it has to be maintained for 2 consecutive days. For VTE and people that have no cancer as long-term anticoagulation, basically the newer oral anticoagulations are the treatments of choice. I give you the names, and I think I put some doses in there for you too. And that's rather than giving them vitamin K, Coumarin and that kind of sort of thing. So that Coumarin's place is going to be downplayed as time goes on. For VTE with cancer as long-term anticoagulation, basically they suggest that people should be on low molecular weight heparin rather than vitamin K and also rather than the newer oral anticoagulation agents. And that's for people with ongoing cancer. Okay. Initial therapy for patients that are either with Pradaxa or with Sabeza, you don't really need to anticoagulate them ahead of time. You don't need to give them heparin and that kind of stuff. Whereas with Xarelto and Eliquis, you do need to give them IV or sub-Q heparin while they're getting anticoagulated. For unprovoked VTE and Allegra PE, they suggested that anticoagulant therapy be given over 3 months rather than for longer terms or shorter terms, that sort of thing. That kind of makes sense. So unprovoked proximal PE, basically they're saying that you extend the anticoagulation for longer periods of time because they may have a hypercoagulable state, et cetera. For proximal DVT of the leg that's provoked by surgery or any other acute event, those patients don't need to be treated with long-term anticoagulation. They can be treated with shorter durations of therapy. Generally, they talk about giving it for 3 months or that, and that's rather than giving longer durations of therapy or other agents. Proximal DVT of the leg or provoked PE in a non-surgical risk factor, again, they recommended 3 months of therapy rather than shorter or longer-term therapy. Now, I mentioned this a couple of slides ago, that it's clear that there's a subpopulation of people that present with pulmonary embolism that are going to do well. They do well in the hospital and probably can be treated as an outpatient. And there's been a couple. Actually, there's another randomized trial since this one that looked at patients that had low risk of the low risk pulmonary embolism versus complications that could be discharged within 24 hours and then treated as outpatients. And that's already been shown. It's also going to be shown, and I think in the next few years, is that a lot of patients that presently are in the hospital now are going to be sent home. Mm-hmm. Other approved agents, Eliquis, I gave you the doses for all these agents, but I seriously doubt you'll be tested on dosing. I haven't any experience with Sabeza yet, but that's on the market. Problem with all of the newer agents is that until recently, we didn't have any reversal agents. But I think for all of these, the newer agents that we use for anticoagulation, that there's going to be development of reversal agents very quickly. So I think that's going to be, in the next couple of years, that problem is going to be solved. The cost, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be solved. I think they're going to continue to be very expensive agents, particularly if the manufacturers know that you don't need to keep the people in the hospital, you can just send them home. They're going to factor that into the equation of what they charge for them. Duration of anticoagulation, we just were talking about. In patients that have irreversible risk factors like factor 5 line, that kind of stuff, basically we're talking about lifelong anticoagulation for those patients is recommended unless they have bleeding or problems. Any thrombotic therapy, basically that is giving people TPA and that kind of stuff, basically is only given to people that have either hemodynamic instability, refractory hypoxemia, the things I talked about before. It's basically, there's a lot of studies right now, as I was saying before, looking at risk strategies to try and predict who in the people that are submassive would benefit from additional therapy. The data's not clear about what we should be doing with that as yet. Now, the problem with lytic therapy is that all my experience is basically with TPA. I've not used urokinase, and I don't think anybody's used streptokinase in a long time. So I think basically TPA is the treatment of choice. The problem is, as this slide alludes to, is that lots of different relative and absolute contraindications. Very often the patients you would like most to treat with a lytic agent, you can't give it because they have an absolute or relative contraindication. That's always frustrating. All right, so beta cable interruption, basically if putting in a beta cable filter is not indicated if you can put the person on anticoagulation. If you can anticoagulate them, don't put a filter in at all. That's what the most recent recommendations say. But if the person has a contraindication, they're actively bleeding, they have recurrent emboli while on adequate therapy, some people add massive embolization to that list, serious bleeding while they're on anticoagulation, you put a filter in. And psychosocial, basically, is somebody that you can't trust to take their medicine again. Get their blood tested. That also is changing. In the past, putting somebody on Coumadin, if you knew they weren't going to get their blood checked and that kind of stuff, you might think twice about putting them on the agents. With some of the newer agents where you don't have to get blood work done, well, that would change that indication as well. All right, last couple of slides I want to talk about is a surgical treatment. In people that have massive embolization and they either can't get lytic therapy or get lytic therapy and fail, we still have the option of going to, it's called pulmonary embolectomy, where they put the person on bypass, they open up the chest and they go into the pulmonary artery and they physically remove the clot. A lot of problems with that approach. So one of the major ones is most patients don't have bypass, so they're not institutions where you can bypass them. And the other issue is that transporting somebody that's unstable to go to one of those institutions is going to be problematic. So that surgical treatment oftentimes is not feasible. 15, 20 years ago, the mortality rate from using this kind of approach was probably in the 50, 60% range. Now the mortality rate has been down to much better, probably in the 23% range. And it's hard to believe that 23% is better, but it's better than it used to be. So having said all that, in a subpopulation of patients that either fail lytic therapy or can't get IV therapy, well, it's still an option that can be used. Oops, one more. Okay, interventional therapies. Now, there's a lot of different catheters that you can thread through the venous system into the pulmonary arterial system and try and lyse the clot. Now, I'm sorry, you can try to lyse the clot with a catheter, but you can do something to try and break up or remove the clot. And there's all kinds of them. There's thrombus fragmentation, where they have a little thing that has a fan on it, goes into the clot, breaks the clot into little microscopic pieces, and they embolize distally into the circulation. There are other ones that are called suction embolectomy, where they go down with the catheter and they try and remove the clot by suction. There's been a couple of studies that have looked at it and all have been kind of positive. Some people advocate the suction, some people like the fragmentation. My own personal feeling is that whatever your interventional radiologist, whatever they're best at, that's probably what you should go with until there's better trials. And this is the last slide. This is a person that's atop that got lytic therapy. You can see they had lytic therapy up in here, and it really didn't do anything to reestablish the pulmonary circulation. They went in with the catheter and broke up the clot and actually were able to reestablish the circulation. And these techniques are much more readily accessible than surgical techniques where you have to go on bypass and that sort of thing. So I think that in the future, for many of our more complex patients, they're probably going to be doing that as our treatment of choice. All right. And it says, sounds grave, very grave. We'll know more when we get the surgery, after the surgery. The autopsy, I'm sorry, I can't even read my own slide. All right, very good.